Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, August 18th, 1995. In the fireside room this morning is David Peters, and he will be speaking on animal liberation, the case for and against. Let's listen in on David Peters.
The document, which is often regarded as the first shot across the bow, indeed the manifesto of the animal liberation movement, was an article that was published in about 1974 in a very prestigious philosophical journal by a person who's come to be regarded as the father of the animal liberation movement, an Australian philosopher whose name is Peter Singer. He was joined later, it was a curious marriage, he was joined later under the animal liberation banner by a philosopher at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill whose name is Tom Reagan. And what is fascinating is that although both of these individuals would count themselves to be part of animal liberation or the humane movement, each offers arguments for their position. They come at this thing from very different runways. They have deep philosophical arguments with each other. Their bottom line is the same, namely that animals, we have to take into consideration what we're doing to animals when we make environmental interventions or in any way do anything which touches animals' lives. And my experience in the past is that for people who have not really met some of the arguments given by these people, they tend to regard this as sort of a cutesy, trendy, far out, facetious, comical kind of thing. But I hope to demonstrate today that they are rather tough-minded people, and some of the arguments they advance for bottom lines that you and I are going to be very uncomfortable with. I chance to think you will find exasperating, because you have to ask yourself, now where did this argument go astray? It seems that all the premises I accept and just sort of say, oh boring, you know, who wouldn't accept that? And then boom, suddenly explodes in your face that if you accept this whole set of premises, you better stop eating meat. You better stop sport hunting. You better stop putting large predatorial animals in zoos. You better stop using elephants in circuses. You better stop bronco busting. You better stop using animals as experimental devices. I mean, the avalanche then comes. Let me just prime the pump a bit here with some purple paragraphs from a non-argumentative article which was written a number of years ago, but recently updated by Peter Singer. And this is not an argument. This is simply a description of how various animals are treated in modern agribusiness. We're simply throwing out these are the facts, and there's no argument. But then I will expose you to some little snippets of Singerian argumentation. I'd like to get your feedback about this. Now, the title of this article is called, one more preface remark. I teach at a campus that has three major colleges in it. Our department is under the College of Arts and Sciences, and then we have a College of Education. But then the third college on our campus is the College of Agriculture. And I have many students in classes who are in animal husbandry or pursuing some very technical discipline within the ag school. And none of these students disagree with the description here. I mean, they concede that this is what goes on. Their defenses take very interesting forms, but as far as whether Pete Singer is reporting the truth, yeah, right. Because they come to a very different conclusion about this than Singer does. Just to prime the pump here. When Nancy and I were first married, she had grand folks that lived down in Pulaski, Kentucky, and we used to go down there, and wow, for a kid raised in the tough streets of Detroit, this was a real eye-opener. I mean, you drove down the little circular road down to the farmhouse, and the chickens would run hither and yon, you know, and the horses be roving around. You'd go in to eat, you know, and the chickens would be clucking outside, and they'd fly just, you know, up to the windowsill, and then maybe some of them would jump inside, and Grandma would shoo the chickens out, and trust me, nobody raises chickens like this anymore. I mean, that is a bygone era. Here's some facts about how broiler chickens are raised today. Today, broilers, as table chickens are now usually called, are produced literally by the million from the highly automated factory-like plants of the large corporations that own or control 98% of all broiler production in the United States. Now, the essential step in turning the chicken from a farmyard bird into a manufactured item, the essential step was confining them indoors. A broiler producer today gets a load of 10,000, 50,000, even more day-old chicks from the hatcheries and puts them straight into a long, windowless shed, usually on the floor, although some producers use tiers of cages in order to get more birds into the same size shed. Inside the shed, every aspect of the bird's environment is controlled to make them grow faster on less feed. Food and water are fed automatically from hoppers suspended from the roof. The lighting is adjusted according to advice from agricultural researchers. For instance, there may be bright light 24 hours a day for the first week or two, to encourage the chicks to gain weight quickly. Then the lights may be dimmed slightly and made to go off and on every 2 hours in the belief that the chickens are readier to eat after a period of sleep. Finally, there comes a point, say around 6 weeks of age, when the birds have grown so much that they're becoming crowded, and the lights will then be made very dim at all times. Now, the point of this dim lighting is to reduce the effects of crowd. Toward the end of the 8 or 9 week life of the chicken, there may be as little as half a square foot of space per chicken, or less than the area of a sheet of, you know, a half sheet of paper for a 3.5 pound bird. Now, under these conditions, with normal lighting, the stress of crowding and the absence of natural outlets for the bird's energies lead to outbreaks of fighting, with birds pecking at each other's feathers and sometimes killing and eating one another. Now, very dim lighting has been found to reduce this, and so the birds are likely to live out their last weeks in near darkness. Well, feather pecking and cannibalism, in the broiler's producer's language, are vices. Of course, they're not natural vices. They're the result of the stress and crowding to which the modern broilerman subjects his birds. Clearly, the farmer has to stop these vices because they cost him money. But although he may know that overcrowding is the root cause, he can't do anything about that, since in the very competitive state of the industry, eliminating overcrowding could mean eliminating his profit margin at the same time. He'd have fewer birds to sell, but he'd have to have the same outlay for his building, the automatic feeding equipment, the fuel used to heat and ventilate the building, and for labor. So the farmer limits his efforts to reducing the consequences of the stress that cost him money. The way in which he keeps his birds causes the vices, but to control them, the poultry man must make conditions still more unnatural. Very dim lighting is one way of doing this. A more drastic step, though now one almost universally used in the industry, is de-beaking. This involves inserting the chick's head in a guillotine-like device which cuts off part of its beak. Alternatively, the operation may be done with a hot knife. Now, some poultrymen claim that this operation is painless, but an extra British government committee under a zoologist by the name of Bramble was appointed to look into this aspect of intensive farming, and he found otherwise. He says, between the horn and the bone is a thin layer of highly sensitive soft tissue resembling the quick of the human nail. The hot knife used in de-beaking cuts through this complex of horn, bone, and sensitive tissue, causing severe pain. Well, de-beaking, which is routinely performed in anticipation of cannibalism, does greatly reduce the amount of damage a chicken can do to other chickens. It also, in the words of Bramble, deprives the bird of what is in effect its most versatile member, while obviously does nothing to reduce the stress and overcrowding that lead to this unnatural cannibalism in the first place. Well, I've got about 8 or 9 pages down on the factory farm. The description of how veal calves are raised to produce nice, pink, succulent meat for veal aficionados will make many of us stop and think. We have a large veal producer in my state of Wisconsin called Provimi Veal that has been hit up by animal livers and picketed and everything. I'm reluctant to read how young veal calves are kept. I mean, it's an exercise and it's just almost unbelievable to those of us who are not trained in that. But then Singer goes on to tell us about what goes on in slaughterhouses, on and on and on. And if you ask, well, why are you telling us all this, Pete? His answer is, just want you to understand the facts. I mean, this is what in fact goes on. These are the things which animals undergo in order to provide you with the cheapest meat possible or the most eggs possible at the cheapest price. I mean, this is the way it is. Nobody can make a living anymore with Bossy out there knee-deep in buttercups just roaming around, and nobody can make money anymore just having, you know, a few chickens that hop around the barnyard. Strongly competitive, and these kinds of ways of raising animals are just part of the game. Okay, let's just start with Peter Singer. Let me run by you initially. I'm just trying to put this in short form, sort of a one-two punch kind of an argument. This is just a sampling of the Singer to come, okay? I mean, but this is indicative of how the guy's mind operates. Now, listen to these arguments. And just ask yourself as we go through this, now which of these premises seems wacko or suspect? I mean, because an argument can go down the tube in either one of two ways. It could be that an argument, all its premises are true, but that the conclusion simply doesn't logically follow, you know, from the premises. I mean, I can say 2 + 2 = 4. That's my first premise. There's carbon dioxide in the atmosphere of Venus. That's my second premise. Therefore, Fidel Castro is the president of Cuba. Fine. I mean, the premises are all true, but that doesn't, I mean, you know, so that's the problem of what the logicians call validity. On the other hand, arguments can go awry, even though the conclusion validly follows. The problem may be that one or the more of the premises are not true. You know, all cats are dogs, all dogs are pigs, therefore all cats are pigs. I mean, you know, if those premises were true, you'd have to derive that conclusion. The problem there is that the premises aren't true. So I'm just asking you, you know, to keep your critical antennae quivering here. I mean, where does this thing go awry, if at all? The first deal here is to claim that pain is an intrinsic, or the pain is bad. Now, I don't know whether you want to go on. Do you want to sit and debate this? Pain is bad. If you ask Singer, if you say, well, I'm not so sure that's true, would you like to give me some reasons for asserting that pain is bad? I suppose that if pressed against the wall, he could come back and simply say, well, look, right. I mean, let's just ask this question. Do you get out of bed every morning and stare at the sun and say, oh, great, another day to be able to experience pain? You know, it's the meaning of my life. I mean, I live for pain. I mean, nobody does that. We put up with pain. We go under the knife for gallbladder operations and do a lot of other stuff, but certainly not just for the experience of pain. Nobody does that. We'll put up with it, but, you know, as a means to either lesser pain in the future or some kind of joy, you know? And somebody might say, yeah, well, pain has some redeeming feature, because if you start to hurt here, that's a signal that maybe you should go see the doctor. I mean, isn't it a blessing that the body is giving you an early warning and so forth? But that still doesn't address the issue as to whether, all things considered, you'd prefer not to have pain. I mean, if you could discover problems without having to endure pain, I think we'd say that. I'm not willing to go to the mat saying, well, I'm not so sure that pain is bad. Let's just concede it. Strikes me as probably a good thing to start off with. Here's another premise. Humans have the capacity to suffer and enjoy things. Now, in a jargon of, I guess, zoology, you probably run into this notion, sentient, S-E-N-T-I-E-N-T, big fat word. All it means is if you have a sentient organism, it's simply capable of experiencing pleasure and pain. Like, plants aren't sentient in that particular sense. So let's just say humans are sentient. Seems true to me. I mean, we're capable of experiencing pleasure and pain. Now listen, therefore, since humans are the kinds of things which can experience pleasure and pain, we have an obligation to refrain from heaping on humans unnecessary, gratuitous, pointless pain. Anybody here want to doubt that? I mean, there's an interesting moral axiom now. We should refrain from heaping on humans unnecessary, pointless, gratuitous pain. Fine. Okay. Now, if you ask, why do I have that obligation? My first answer is, well, because humans are capable of experiencing pleasure and pain is bad, and we should refrain from doing what is bad, namely heaping unnecessary, pointless pain. So far, it seems fun. Now, here's an interesting premise. Equals should be treated equally. Now, this is technically known in philosophy as the principle of consistency in reasoning. Equals must be treated equally. Let me try and gain your confidence that if you don't buy this premise, you are vulnerable to the charge that you should turn in your Homo sapien card. I mean, if you don't accept this, you're vulnerable to the charge that you're irrational. Now, let's just illustrate this without having anything that has anything to do with ethics. Just suppose that I draw two triangles on the board. Here's A, here's B. And let's just suppose that you go up with a protractor and a ruler, and you examine this with the most sophisticated instruments, and you concede that these are identical. in all relevant respects. I mean, they're all equilateral triangles, same length of the sides and same angles. They're all 180, you know, all 60 degrees. Now, suppose you know that I concede that these are identical. They're equal. And then suppose you hear me go on to ascribe different geometrical properties to A than I do to B. Now, you want to say, let's go back to square one. I thought you said that these are similar or equal. Right. Well, how can this have different geometrical properties than that? I mean, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. I say, well, they do. And you say, hold it, you're not treating equals equally. What's the difference between B over against A, which justifies the differential treatment of B, than A? Now listen, suppose my answer to you is, oh, there's no difference. I mean, now you're starting to think, I think maybe he has the intelligence of a fern, or he's not seeing. So what do you mean there's no difference? He's treating equals unequally, and he's not giving a reason for the differential treatment. And you keep pressing me. Say, well, why do you treat B differently? Where the treatment is the description of different geometrical properties. And you keep asking me, you know, if I keep saying, well, there isn't any difference, and you'll say, oh, man, I mean, you're not playing with a full deck. And you keep pressing me and say, well, there's got to be some difference between B and A. If you're going to treat B differently, said, oh, and suppose I say, all right, B is to the right of A. You want a difference, I give you a difference. He said, well, what the hell does that have to do with this? I mean, it's not a, you give me a difference, but it's not a relevant difference, which justifies a differential treatment. Fade to gray. Let's just show the same thing in a moral zone. Suppose you're visiting me in my office, and we're having a conversation, and some student, you know, knocks on the door and comes in and says, Mr. Peters, we have this paper due this Friday in this class, and I've really been whacked out, you know, with a flu the last 3 days, and I couldn't get my head together, and I want to do well on this paper, and I just, could I have an extension till Monday for the paper? I hand it in at 9 o'clock on Monday. And I say, you overhear me say, fine. Okay, we talk some more. Another knock on the door, and a student comes in and says, you know, we got this paper due Friday, and you know, the flu's been going around. I've just been socked in with this thing, and you know, I feel mushy-minded, and I want to do well on the paper, and could I possibly hand it in on Monday at 9? And you hear me say, no. Well, what's the student supposed to say? Okay, so she goes away with her tail between her legs and so forth. Now, what I think you ought to do is to simply say, I couldn't help but overhearing this. Why did you deny the extension to the second person rather than the first person? Because your intuition is that the situations are similar. Now, suppose I say, oh, no reason. You said, well, you better damn well have a reason. I mean, but I don't have it. Why do I have to have a reason? Well, because you're violating the principle of consistency in reasoning, see? And you keep hitting me up. He said, but you got to have a reason. You treated differentially people that were equals. And I'll say, you want a reason? The reason I denied it to the woman that came in second is because she wore yellow socks. You want a reason I gave you a reason? Yeah, but it's not a relevant reason, okay? You're not letting me off the hook. I can't get away with intellectual murder by violating a principle of consistency in reasoning. If you see me doing that, you're saying, the guy's demented. You can't fudge that particular principle. Just as an aside, I would tempt you with a very interesting insight that was trotted out by a German philosopher by the name of Immanuel Kant. And Immanuel Kant went to the trouble of showing that what is called the golden rule, do unto others as you would others do unto you, follows like a theorem in geometry from the principle of consistency in reasoning. And this is very interesting because To be rational is to see the point of the golden rule, that the golden rule stands on its own intellectual merits and would be true, according to Kant, if Judas said it, Pontius Pilate said it, or Saddam Hussein said it. It doesn't matter who said it. It stands on its own merits. Okay, let's just suppose that in addition to this claim that pain is bad, humans can suffer pain, and that's why we have an obligation to refuse from keeping unnecessary pain on humans, we now added to the pot the principle that equals ought to be treated equally. And you conceded, yeah, I can't abandon that. Now suppose I tell you that animals are relevantly like humans because animals can experience pleasure and pain. Now there have been some people in the history of Western philosophy who have denied that animals can feel pleasure and pain. Among them, founder of modern philosophy by the name of René Descartes. There was a 17th century mathematician by the name of Nicolas Malebranche who wrestled with an eternal problem that all people in Christianity and some other world religions have. It's called the problem of evil. I mean, how can you square the existence of an allegedly all-good, all-powerful God with the existence of evil in the world? Because, you know, if God were all-powerful, well, he could simply say evil kiss off and be gone. And if you mean by all powerfulness what you mean, if God were all loving, I would assume he'd want to get rid of evil, but evil's alive and well, so either God is not all loving or all powerful. Boom. I mean, you know, it's a standard argument. Nicolas Malebranche felt the force of this and held to this view that all evil suffered by humans, he comes to the same conclusion concerning this as the guys that are sitting around with Job on the dung piles. I mean, they're all accusing Job of having committed some great sin, you know, and that's why he's suffering. You know, all evil is God's punishment for sin. So Nicky Malebranche believes this this explanation of evil. Then it came clear to him that it seemed as though animals could suffer, but on the theory that all suffering is punishment for sin, and then you add in the premise, but animals can't sin, they're not moral creatures, it seems as though God is unjust. We can't have an unjust God, so the resolution of this is contrary to appearances, animals do not suffer. I mean, that's, you know, it's... Animals are constructed such that if you step in a cat's tail, a squeak comes out in the other end or something. I mean, they're like machines. Okay, none of us believe that. Let's just concede that animals are relevantly like humans in that they too can suffer. So we have an equality condition between humans and animals, and equals must be treated equal. If we agree that it's morally wrong to heap unnecessary, gratuitous pain on humans because we're sentient, and if animals are relevantly like humans because they too are sentient, do we not have a moral obligation not to heap unnecessary gratuitous pain on animals? Seems as though we're driven to that conclusion. End of argument A. We got a beachhead. Now, and let's mix in another argument.
You espouse the equality because...
They're equal to the extent that we're both sentient.
Okay,
that's all the argument purports to establish here. I mean, Singer's view is that we generate the duty not to inflict needless, pointless, gratuitous harm on humans. If you ask, why? Well, because humans can suffer pain, and pain is bad. I mean, that's how we get there. I mean, there's no fancy Dan argument. It's just we go right for it. Okay? Here's another argument. You have to add this one to the one we just entertained here. Now we've got this mediating conclusion that we have a moral obligation not to heap unnecessary, gratuitous, pointless pain on animals, right? That's where we're at. Push it. Humans are omnivores. Now that simply means we're ambidextrous with respect to food sources. I mean, we can either eat cereals and grains or we can eat meat. It's part of our survival gimmick. We're omnivores. Now, if we're omnivores, it is Singer's view that nobody here can make the claim that we need, underlined three times in red ink, meet to either survive or to survive well. Now say, oh, yes, we do. Yes, we do. Well, let's just point to the Indian cultures and all these veggies around here would seem to be doing very well. I mean, you can't make the claim that we need meat to either survive or survive well. Okay? Now we have to ask the question, well, why is it that we eat meat given that we don't need it? And the answer which he entertains is we eat meat because fundamentally we prefer the taste of meat to vegetables. Uh-huh. It's a taste preference. That's it. I think he's probably about that in our culture. I mean, if somebody says, well, what do you have here? We either have filet mignon or tofu. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I mean, most of us are not veggies. I mean, we like to masticate. We're sort of a chewy culture. We like meat. Now, there's our reason for eating it, not because we need it, but because we prefer the taste. And Singer happens to think that that's a rather trivial interest of ours. I just prefer it.
I heard kind of a spin on that, evolutionary-wise, the reason why we crave fat, for example, you know, a good fatty meal, was we didn't have fats, and we had to actually be the hunter-gatherer, you know, to go out and get an animal, and it was that drive, and that's why fat was flavorful, as opposed to grains. And grains were so bountiful that they didn't have that same taste sensation, and that's why we're still not motivated to just go out and graze. And so it was an interesting spin to hear this gentleman talk about, you know, why like sweets are sweet to us, not because they have any discrete reason why they're sweet, it's because we couldn't get sweets.
Huh.
And the reason fats are so tasty is because we couldn't get...
And so Mother Nature...
Kind of like put the little...
You need it, and the way evolution works is things that you need tend to be things that you like to do. Like, it's probably no accident that Homo sapiens would simply kiss off if we didn't procreate, and copulation is a very pleasurable kind of thing. I mean, nature usually associates a kind of a pleasure with those things which are needful. Okay? All right. So man is an omnivore. We don't need meat. Question is, why do we eat it? The answer is because we prefer it. Now, let's just go back to the description of how animals are treated in modern agribusiness so as to get to us meat. Now, one thing you should conclude from reading down on the factory farm is that under modern agribusiness, animals suffer pain. They do. And now, remember the claim that we entertained that it's wrong to heap pointless, gratuitous, needless pain on animals? Now let's circle back to the premise that we don't need meat to either survive or survive well. So what we now have is a whole enterprise called modern animal husbandry, which heaps pain on animals in order to produce something we don't need. It seems as though we are in the business of fudging the principle of refraining from heaping unnecessary pain upon animals by forcing these animals to undergo pain to produce a product that we don't need. Ergo, you're all guilty. Well, let's just stop there. There's one line of argument. Now the question is, where did the guy go wrong? I mean, which of those premises are suspect? And does that conclusion that we should stop eating meat follow from those reasons?
My wife presented that she said that we're not equal. That was her position. That no way, and I think she basically took it from the religious aspect of it. She said, when we're blowing up all our premises, we finally said that the triangles are equal and that we're equal to animals.
That's one way to attack this argument.
They're not equal, and if they experience pain, that's fine, but they're because they're not equal to us.
Okay.
And that's how she rationalized it out.
Now, you see, what Singer's done is that he tried to isolate a respect, an aspect of humanness and animalness in which we are equal, and that was called sentience. You see, he tried to isolate some common feature among animals and simply said, well, in that regard, we're equal. And if your reason, if the reason as to why it's morally wrong to heap unnecessary pain upon humans is simply because they can experience pain and pain is bad, then the argument follows for animals.
To me, there's some hidden premise in there when you jump from the point, like humans can experience pleasure and pain, and therefore we should not inflict pain on other humans. There's a premise that it's wrong to inflict pain just because you don't like pain yourself, and that it seems like it's making a jump there in terms of, I'm not saying it's a wrong jump, I think there are legitimate reasons to say you should treat other humans equally, the golden rule, but I think it goes beyond just the fact that they can experience pain.
Okay, this is what you, this is what you're, okay, now let's just make a move. I'm putting on an all points bulletin here. A lot follows from this. I mean, you can see that if you bought the argument so far, not only do you have a mini case for vegetarians, and please note that this argument, this two-step argument I've just given to you, doesn't try and show why we should move to a vegetarian diet on grounds that your veins won't be, your arteries and veins won't be plaqued up with grunge. You'll live longer. I mean, all these health reasons are abandoned. That's not where they want to fight this. They want to fight it on the business of the inhumane treatment of animals. I mean, they don't care about these health arguments. So let's just go back and see whether we can work within a premise set. If you want to deny, you think that one of the slippery moves here is the equalizing of humans and animals. And there's something slipshod about...
Even before you got to that step, though, just going from the fact that the reason you treat humans, don't inflict pain on humans is because they can experience pain. That's a jump. It might be because they can experience pain and because you're human and you can sympathize with the pain, you know what it means to be human, and I don't want to put that on someone else.
Okay.
There's about two more premises in there. That, I being human, then therefore know what the pain experience is for another human.
Well, let's work around this. There are some subtleties here. It seems to me that there are two questions. The fundamental question is whether you want to admit at all some obligation to refrain from heaping unnecessary pain upon animals. I could turn it around and simply say the first question we need to get is, are you willing to concede, for example, the right, listen to this new talk, animals' rights not to be subjected to pointless, gratuitous pain. Now, if you are, okay, then another question is to whether the rights of animals, you're conceding that it's sane to talk about animals' rights, but there's a second order question, namely as to whether the rights of animals, when they come to loggerheads with the rights of humans, are equal. Or do human rights in any way trump the rights of animals when they come into irrevocable conflict? See, now that's a separate question. Some people don't even want to go with it.
It's still the equalities question.
Right.
That's exactly it. Okay, so let's just wrestle with the second thing. Are you comfortable with the notion that it's not cockamamie to attribute rights to animals not to be subjected to pointless pain? Okay, we settled that issue then. We're not arguing about that. For some people, like Immanuel Kant, bless his heart. It's unbelievable. Another example of how only great minds can make great mistakes. Kant would want to deny that it was even sane to attribute rights to animals, or that we had any direct obligations to animals. The theory he entertained was that animals are not rational, and we're rational, and animals can't understand the notion of rights. They can't have moral obligations, and in order to have moral rights, you have to be able to have moral duties, so they're parked out. Now the question is, well, does that mean we can do anything we want to animals? And his answer was, no. Would you like to explain this? I mean, does that mean we can be cruel to animals? And listen to this answer. He says, no. We shouldn't be cruel to animals, not because the animals have got any rights, or we have any obligations directly to animals. Rather, Kant held the only obligations that we as humans have are to other people like us who have reason, okay? Because you can understand obligations and you can have rights, and our only obligations are to each other as humans. The reason we shouldn't be cruel to animals is because if we are, we build up a psyche of callousness and I don't careness, which then might come out in our relations with other humans. So we should be kind to animals as little practice targets, so we will be kind to our brothers. You see this? You can try and get the same conclusion by this circuitous kind of a reasoning. But you're willing to say, I think Kant is off the deep end. You're willing to concede rights.
Yeah, I mean, I can see other ways to come to the same conclusion. We should take care of God's creation because it's good for humankind to have a good environment. We should take care of animals because they add to our environment. So even just arguing from people, you can get to some of the same conclusions.
How about this? What would you think would be a good candidate for the distinction between humans and animals, which give humans some sort of moral superiority in a universe, such that if human interests come to loggerheads with animal interests, and there's an irrevocable conflict, that human interests take precedence. I mean, what is it about humans that just separates us? What's the Rubicon that we cross?
My wife liked to say that we had souls and animals don't.
Now, let's just pursue this. We have souls and animals don't. I once took probably one of the most revealing classes that I ever took. I was in college, and I took Old Testament taught by a rabbi. And man, I'll tell you, I left that class, I came, you know, as a Missouri Synod Lutheran, and man, I'll tell you, it was the day of revelation. Because what this rabbi kept trying to say is, and he succeeded in convincing me, is that we read both his books, the Old Testament, and our own books, the New Testament, through Greek goggles. And what he succeeded in convincing me of, and the more I studied this, the guy was right on the button, that when we see this word S-O-U-L, which translates Hebrew words and Greek words, we look at that, and you know what our instinct is? He said, try this on. Soul. What do you mean by a soul? And there was almost unanimity of agreement among the kids in the class. Well, that's the real thoughty, thinky, cerebral me, which is different from my body. Okay? I mean, my soul is my thoughty, rational self, and salvation is really getting this outer husk of me and releasing this thoughty, thinky me, which can go on without a bod. He says, you stand condemned. You stand condemned. Because the ancient Hebrew doesn't mean that by soul. Yahweh forms this Pygmalion kind of a figure out of the dust of the ground and goes, breathes in his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living soul. And he says, look, what that means is that before the breath was injected, what you had was earth. The word hadam literally means earth, soil. I mean, Hebrew names are very important. Esau means the hairy one. Moses means drawn from the water. I mean, listen to all these. I mean, these names are revelatory of certain things. And so all you mean in the Old Testament, somebody being a soul, is that you have breathified dust. Absent breath, you got a carcass. Then he asks us the really embarrassing question, how many of you Christians out there believe that salvation is the salvation of the soul from the body? You know, everybody raises their hand. Says, that's really funny. As I read your documents, I thought that Easter was about the resurrection of the body. Where do you guys come to this? This notion that salvation is salvation of the soul from the body. Your own tradition doesn't justify it. I mean, whatever Paul is talking about in 1 Corinthians 15 about spiritual bodies or something, whatever that means, I mean, some people think, well, that's like round squares and married bachelors, a spiritual body. But however you want to argue about it, not even Paul can conceive of an existence beyond this earth without a body. I mean, he's a Hebrew. I mean, so is Jesus. I mean, and you ask, where do we get this notion that Saul is this thoughty thinky cerebral me that can exist without the body? And, you know, since I've gotten into philosophy full time, I know exactly where it is. It goes right back to the guy whose theorem you memorized in geometry, whose name was Pythagoras. That's where Plato got it from. I mean, this whole notion that soul is something you own or have inside of an external body, that's Pythagorean. I mean, that's neither Judaism nor Christianity. So all you mean by soul is something which has breath. Breathified, respirating soil. But then, you see, even in the Old Testament, animals satisfy that criterion. I mean, animals are called souls and everything. So now we haven't got something, you say, well, what separates humans from animals, the relevant dissimilarity is that we've got souls and animals have it. Well, on this larger scale analysis, that doesn't work. Now where are we? So what do we mean by this? What is it?
Well, when I think of that, I mean, first of all, you know, I'm familiar with the Hebrew concept of soul being your whole being, and I think of that being having three aspects, your physical body, your mental intellect, and your spiritual side. And when I think of the spiritual side, I think that's the way we were created in the image of God. We're certainly not created in the image of God in body.
Okay, now we're wrestling with what we mean by this famous term, the Imago Dei, the image of God. I mean, what is that? Well, it doesn't seem to be equatable with only humans have souls. That doesn't seem to be a candidate. So how is it that humans alone are like God and no animal or plant is?
If you go back to your equality, then they have to be also. When the syllogism continues on.
But I think we're uncomfortable with this. We somehow have this intuitive reaction both from our own tradition as well as just horse sense that somehow there's some difference that makes a difference between humans and animals, that it's false that all creation is created equal. The title of Singer's Manifesto, which kicked off the animal liberation movement, was, I don't know what I told you, it's called All Animals Are Equal. That was the title. Human animals, other animals, we're all equal. Bell, boom, you know, this is exactly what we're debating.
When I think of the spiritual side, it's something that's hard to pin down, but I think it's this thing that makes us seek God, the same way that the craving for sweets or fats might make us seek certain foods. I think our spiritual nature makes us seek something beyond and above ourselves.
We may be getting close to it, that the thing which separates us from the animals is our capacity to have self-understanding, including an understanding of our relationship to God. And Coco and Lena, those great gorillas that make the front pages of National Geographic and talk American Sign Language and Punch-Out, typewriters and they have two-way communications. I mean, they're great beasts, but arguably, they haven't got this capacity. Okay? I'll tell you where Tom Reagan comes from on this particular issue. We've just suggested that maybe the sense in which humans are not equal to animals is that only humans have the capacity to know God. Okay? Reagan, I think, understands that there are certain problems politically in using an argument like that, because in a public forum, you're going to have out there a grand mixture of atheists, agnostics, Christians, and it's simply inappropriate, as we talked about in conjunction with capital punishment issue, it's simply inappropriate. I mean, just consider an argument which some well-meaning Christian might come in with. You know, if the state of Wisconsin is debating a bill to legalize Jack Kevorkian physician-assisted suicide, suppose somebody gets up there, I'm trying to get you into Reagan's mindset, somebody gets up there and simply says, ladies and gentlemen, I think we should vote against this bill, and I'll tell you why. Only God is the giver of life, and only God has the right to take life, and if anybody takes their own life, they're usurping a right that's reserved for God. And ladies and gentlemen, I tell you that you should vote no. Well, I think what Reagan is saying is that most people on the floor are going to be bewildered by this. I mean, this is not the kind of argument which is licit in a public forum, because you're going to have atheists out there and so forth. They're going to come in and say, well, you just dug your hole deeper. Now, what we have to end up debating is whether there really is a God, because you're trying to get authoritative moral pronouncements by appealing to the God hypothesis. Do you want this assembly now to end into a philosophical discussion concerning the nature of God, or whether God exists? I mean, we're not being paid by the taxpayers to do that. I mean, you know. So let's work with some lowest common denominator shared values which are neutral, you know, to the Christian, non-Christian. I mean, that's just the practicalities of public debate. So Reagan is privy to this, and what Reagan says then is probably a more acceptable acceptable premise is that the thing which separates humans from animals is what he would call human capacity for moral autonomy. Now, let me unpack that. That's a great big word, and my students just feel like they're sniffing glue, you know, when they hear the moral capacity for moral autonomy. What is that? Okay, it really has two phases. Here's something that we can do as humans, which no animal can do. We not only act and behave, but we have this interesting capacity to stand back and play spectator to our actings. Stand back and ask this question. Here I am proposing to do this, or acting in this way. Only we can raise this question, but should I be doing this? Well, only we can subject our actions to ethical analysis. Coco can't do it. Blaina can't do it. Dolphins can't do it, as far as I know. They can't. We alone can appraise our actions according to ethical standards. But there's one more little ratchet turn. Not only can we appraise our actions according to ethical rules, and no animal can do that, but we can stand back even further and ask the question, are the rules that I'm appraising my actions by rationally acceptable rules? Wow. I mean, listen to this. I mean, this really removes us. And then you can come zipping through and simply say, we were on the lookout for some distinction, morally relevant, between animals and humans. And I could simply say, I can't think of a more morally relevant distinction than the capacity for moral autonomy. I mean, it's almost self-certifying. Now, he sort of thinks that we can probably gain public acceptance of this, and that's enough. I mean, we don't need to appeal to the Imago Dei or anything. I mean, you probably get general across the board acceptance. Where do we go with this then? Let's go back to the original argument. So now we've established that if human interests come to loggerheads, to irrevocable loggerheads with animal interests, that human interests have given arguments to why they should take preference, because man is morally more important than other animals because of possession of moral autonomy. But let's go back to the argument he offered. We don't need meat. We don't need it. I mean, the interest we have in eating meat is not a vital, basic interest. It's simply false that we will be seriously harmed by pulling away from meat. And it's a tremendous interest to the animal as to whether he or she lives a pained life or dies. We've got fundamental interests of animals pitted against trivial interests of humans. So even though we've established human superiority, does that just allow us to eat animals? I mean, we're right back to that question. Nothing really goes away. Want me to thicken the plow a little more? Let Peter Singer come through the door. Somebody says, oh, the capacity for moral autonomy. Oh, great, I accept that. Now here's the problem, Singer would say, I have. What about young children that come into the world with gross genetic disabilities, gross neurological damage? They're sentient, but they are not now, and they never can be, morally autonomous. Now, why wouldn't it be okay to take these defectives who are not now and never can be morally autonomous? Remember, we isolated this as a distinct feature, the Rubicon? Why would it be okay for Johnson & Johnson down in Racine, if they're going to test the new tearless shampoo for kids, why wouldn't it be okay, instead of using, you know, rabbits like they usually do, rabbits don't have any tear ducts, then the Dreyse test, you've probably seen these pictures, but the rabbit's head protruding through like stalks, you know, like the Puritans used to use, so their paws can't get up to fend off the researcher, and we go through with a little eyedropper, and we have some new formula, and we drop it in the eye, and of course, if the eye swells up and falls out of the socket, well, I guess we don't want to do that. You wouldn't want to give that to your kids, would you? I mean, why don't we just use a young, defective, neurologically defective infants for this? Because arguably, the rabbits we do use on a scale of 1 to 10 in terms of self-awareness, self-directingness, I mean, they're probably more rationally superior to this infant now than is the infant now and never will be. And so how can we justify using a rabbit and not using a young child?
Well, if you're just going to base your life on rationalism and keep God out of the picture, I don't think you can make an argument not to use the infant. To me, it goes back to God again. And the existence of a creator who's made us spiritual beings, and that's something that goes beyond the intellect and the reason.
So you're pointing to one of the liabilities of just going with this moral autonomy criterion, because the argument I just deduced gets you in trouble. If that's all you're going to bootleg in as the big difference. It's interesting to see what the move would be on a part of someone who's trying to argue non-religiously against this kind of objection. And, you know, how palatable is this argument? To the question, well, why shouldn't we use defective newborns as guinea pigs? Mm-hmm. there are two arguments that could come forward. First of all, that if we ever get in the position of treating members, very young members of our species, in this cruel way, that it's going to create, now that I'm sounding like Kant in a way here, it's sort of a Kantian argument, it's going to create a sense of abandoning the sacredness of life. It's going to qualify our ethic of care for our brethren. And man, as we grow old and get senile and get into big trouble, we know that we're now going to live in a culture that's sort of sacrificed. An ethic of care for the least of us, and it might redound to our disbenefit as we move into our senior years. Now, there's an argument. It wouldn't be in our collective self-interest as humans to do this.